The following chapter is from a book called The Mather Family by Enoch Pond. Enoch Pond was a professor at Bangor Theological Seminary in Maine in the last century for 50 years. Having briefly sketched the life and character of the Reverend Cotton Mather, it remains that I attempt to vindicate him so far as this can be done consistently with truth from some of the aspersions which in our own times have been heaped upon him. The first and most formidable of the objections referred to is that growing out of Mr. Mather's supposed connection with the subject of witchcraft. This, therefore, it will be necessary to examine at some length and with care. In the first place, I remarked that Cotton Mather was a sincere and earnest believer in the reality and not infrequent occurrence of what in his day was denominated witchcraft. He also believed that the crime of witchcraft, when proved, was justly punishable with death. Nor was his faith in regard to these points at all singular. It was a common faith of Christendom and had been so for hundreds of years. Persons who have not attended particularly to the subject can have no idea of the extent to which the supposed crime of witchcraft has prevailed in different countries and a multitude of deaths which it has occasioned. In the latter part of the 16th century, not only hundreds but thousands were put to death, many of them by the extremest tortures, in Germany, France, and Spain, under the imputation of witchcraft. In 1612, 15 persons were indicted and 12 executed in Lincolnshire, England, and in 1634, 17 more were put to death in the same county. The Reverend Thomas Cooper, one of the ministers of this county, in his Mystery of Witchcraft, published in 1617, says, "Does not every assizes, almost throughout the land, resound of the arraignment and conviction of notorious witches?" Between the years 1644 and 1646, a celebrated witch hunter, Matthew Hopkins, was encouraged and employed to visit different parts of England, ferret out those who dealt with familiar spirits, and in bringing them to justice. Through his instrumentality, 16 were executed at Yarmouth, 15 at Chelmsford, 1 at Cambridge, several in Huntingdon, and 60 in the single county of Suffolk. In the year 1664, Sir Matthew Hale presided at the trial of 2 females in Suffolk, supposed to be witches. At these trials, Sir Thomas Brown attended as a witness who declared his opinion in favor of the reality of witchcraft and entered into a particular discussion of the subject before the jury. Near the close of the 17th century, many were tried and condemned in England under the administration of Chief Justice Holt. It is stated by Mr. Upham that in this century alone, the 17th, more than 200 were hanged in England, thousands were burned in Scotland, and large numbers perished in various parts of Europe for the supposed crime of witchcraft. In the year 1670, 85 witches were condemned in Sweden, the most of whom, if not all, were burned and executed. There were also 36 children that ran the gauntlet, and 20 were whipped every Sunday at the church door for 3 weeks together for the same crime. About the middle of this century, the 17th, a narrative of an alleged case of witchcraft was published in France under the title of The Devil of Mascon. The celebrated Robert Boyle gave his sanction to the work, promoted the translation of it into English, and publicly declared his belief of the supernatural transaction it related. Sir William Blackstone, the great oracle of British law who died no longer ago than 1780, declared his belief in witchcraft in the following terms: "To deny the possibility, nay, the actual existence of witchcraft and sorcery, is at once flatly to contradict the revealed word of God in various passages, both of the Old and New Testaments, and the thing itself is a truth to which every nation in the world has, in its turn, borne testimony, either by examples seemingly well attested, or by prohibitory laws, which at least suppose the possibility of commerce with evil spirits." In New England, at the time of Cotton Mather, the belief in witchcraft may be said to have been universal. The most experienced physicians who were called to prescribe for the afflicted persons, and the most eminent ministers who were invited to pray with them, did not hesitate to pronounce them bewitched. Even those persons who had the least sympathy with the Mathers on some subjects, as Thomas and William Brattle, John Leverett, and Robert Califf, all agreed with them as to the reality of witchcraft. In the year 1694, 2 years subsequent to the executions at Salem, a paper was issued by the president and fellows of Harvard College and signed, among others, by Samuel Willard, John Leverett, and William Brattle, inviting observation and information concerning apparitions, possessions, enchantments, and all extraordinary things in which the existence and agency of the invisible world is more sensibly demonstrated. Nor was the belief in witchcraft in this country confined to New England. In the early settlement of Pennsylvania, William Penn presided on the bench at the trial of two Swedish women for witchcraft, both of whom would have been condemned and executed but for some technical error in the indictment. French and Dutch ministers of New York, when their opinion was asked by the Chief Justice of that province, replied in writing, "If we believe in no venific witchcraft, we must renounce the scripture of God and the consent of almost all the world." The last book that the celebrated Richard Baxter ever published was the treatise on the immortality of the soul and the reality of the world of spirits, established by undoubted cases of apparitions, possessions, witchcrafts, and so on. And so, late as the year 1720, Dr. Isaac Watts, in a letter to Cotton Mather respecting the Salem witchcraft, says, "I am persuaded that there was much immediate agency of the devil in those affairs, and perhaps there were some real witches," end quote. I have cited these testimonies for the purpose of showing at one view how general, and I might almost say universal, was the belief in witchcraft 150 years ago. Cotton Mather was not singular in his opinions on this subject. He would have been singular if he had indulged another opinion. He spoke the truth when he said in his reply to Caliph, "I know not that I have ever advanced any opinion in a matter of witchcraft, but what all the ministers of the Lord that I know of in the world, whether English or Scotch or French or Dutch, and I know many, are of the same opinion with me." If there was any difference between Mr. Mather and his contemporaries on the point before us, it was perhaps this, that owing to his natural credulity and love of the marvelous, he was more sincere and earnest in his belief than some of them, a fact of considerable importance in this inquiry, and which, if duly considered, will go not to inculpate, but rather to excuse him. It has been said Cotton Mather was the chief cause and promoter of the alleged witchcrafts in New England. He had an efficient agency in producing and prolonging the excitement on that subject. He connected his name and fame inseparably with that excitement as his chief cause, agent, believer, and justifier. Quincy's History of Harvard College, Volume 1, pages 63 and 65. The excitement here referred to is without doubt that commonly spoken of as the Salem witchcraft, which occurred in 1692. Of this, Cotton Mather is alleged to have been the chief cause, promoter, agent, and justifier. He exerted an, quote, efficient agency in producing and prolonging it, end quote. This certainly is a heavy charge to be brought against a learned and reputable minister of the gospel who has long been dead. Let us spend a few moments in inquiring as to his justness and truth. We have seen that in the days of Cotton Mather, the belief in witchcraft was universal in New England, as indeed it seems to have been all over the world. He did not originate this belief. He merely fell in with the general current of thought and feeling, which had prevailed here from the first settlement of the country. It must be remembered, too, that the cases of witchcraft at Salem were not regarded at the time of their occurrence as a new or unheard of thing. Accounts of witches in England and in other parts of Europe had been often published, and the stories and books were widely circulated. Then there had been cases of supposed witchcraft in New England for almost half a century before the disturbances at Salem. There was a case of Springfield as early as 1645 and another at Charleston immediately after, which resulted in the execution of the supposed witch. The next that suffered was a woman in Dorchester and another in Cambridge, both of whom died protesting their innocence. In 1665, Mrs. Hibbins, a widow of one who had been an assistant or counselor, was executed at Boston. There were three executed at Springfield nearly at the same time, one of whom confessed herself guilty of the crime alleged. All these cases occurred in New England before Cotton Mather was born. In the year 1662, the year of his birth, there were three executed at Hartford, one of them on her own confession. There was a case at Salisbury in 1669, another at Groton in 1671, a third at Hampton in 1673, and a fourth at Newbury in 1679. In 1682, there were two cases in New Hampshire, and in the next 2 years, there were two more cases on the Connecticut River. These latter cases varied much in their circumstances, and in none of them were the supposed offenders executed. There was a notable case of witchcraft in the family of Mr. Goodwin in Boston in the year 1688. The alleged offender was an old Irish woman by the name of Glover. She was tried before Chief Justice Dudley, afterwards Governor Dudley, and was condemned and executed. This case, it has been said, was brought about by the management of Cotton Mather, Upham's Lectures, page 107, but a more unfounded accusation perhaps never was uttered. It is expressly contradicted by the testimony of Mr. Goodwin, the father of the afflicted children. Quote, "Let the world be informed," he says, "that when one of my children had been laboring under sad circumstances from the invisible world for about a quarter of a year, I desired the ministers of Boston and Charleston to keep a day of prayer at my home, if so be deliverance might be obtained. Mr. Cotton Mather was the last of the ministers that I spoke to on that occasion, and though by reason of some necessary business he could not attend, yet he came to my house on the morning of that day, and tarried about half an hour and went to prayer with us before any other minister came. Never before now had I the least acquaintance with him. How, then, could this case have been brought about by the management of Cotton Mather? The child had been afflicted full 3 months, during which time Mr. Mather had not once visited the house, or had the slightest acquaintance with the family. But to come back to the strange appearances in Salem Village, called Danvers, Massachusetts, which, as before remarked, commenced in February of 1692, and in the family of the Reverend Mr. Paris, the minister, that Mather was, quote, the chief cause of these appearances, as has been confidently asserted, or that he exerted the slightest agency or instrumentality in producing them, there is not a particle of proof. After diligent search, I can find no evidence that he had any visible concern, or in fact any concern, with the cases of alleged witchcraft in Salem until several months after the excitement commenced. Mr. Upham supposes that this excitement originated in the parochial troubles of Mr. Paris, and that the children of Paris, quote, were acting a part, end quote. I am constrained, he says, to declare my belief that this dreadful transaction was introduced and driven on by wicked perjury and willful malice, end quote. Lectures on Witchcraft, pages 51, 55, 106, and 114. If this account of its origin be true, certainly Cotton Mather can no longer be regarded as its chief cause, promoter, and agent, end quote, as it will not be pretended that he had any concerns in fomenting Mr. Paris's parochial troubles. But Mr. Mather is represented not only as the cause of the Salem witchcraft, but as greatly desiring it and rejoicing in it. Quote, I cannot resist the conviction, says one, that he looked upon the Salem trials with secret pleasure, end quote. Quote, he seems to have longed for an opportunity to signalize himself in this particular kind of warfare, end quote. Bancroft's History of the United States, Volume 3, page 85. His boundless vanity, says another, quote, gloried in the assault of the evil angels upon the country. Were Cotton Mather now living to speak for himself, or could he address us from the other world, I am persuaded he would repel the foregoing representations as doing great injustice to his character. But his accusers know that he longed for the occurrence of cases of witchcraft, and rejoiced in them when they appeared, and regarded their terrible bloody results with secret pleasure. Believing sincerely in the reality of witchcraft, or that certain individuals were in covenant and commerce with evil spirits, when an instance of this kind was supposed to have occurred, he would feel an interest, both as a Christian and a philosopher, to investigate it, with all the scrutiny of which he was capable. But to suppose that he desired the occurrence of these terrible visitations, and rejoiced in them, and contemplated their results with secret satisfaction, even when they terminated in blood, is to contradict not only his most solemn protestations, but the general current of his actions in life. He universally spoke of the spring and summer of 1682 as, quote, a very doleful time unto the whole country, end quote. And of, quote, the descent of the devils upon so many of the good people of the land, end quote, and as a, quote, dreadful judgment of heaven. His biographer informs us that for a great part of the summer he spent one day every week by himself, and he exercises as a secret fast before the Lord, praying not only for his own preservation from the malice and power of the evil angels, but also for a good issue of the calamities in which he had permitted the evil angels to ensnare the miserable country. And if the general current of one's life is to be regarded as an index to the state of his heart, then Cotton Mather was a benevolent and not a malevolent man. He desired the good of his fellow creatures and not their hurt. He was liable, like other men, to mistake in the application of means and to be deluded, but he sincerely sought to be useful to those around him. But how is this consistent with his longing to witness and rejoicing in the occurrence of what he conceived to be the most dreadful of all calamities, perpetrated by the most horrible of all crimes, a crime justly deserving of death by the laws of both God and man? It is further objected to Cotton Mather that he favored the prosecutions for witchcraft, countenanced the executions by his presence, and in various ways urged on the terrible work of blood, end quote. Quote, in the progress of the superstitious fear, says his accuser, when it amounted to frenzy and could only be satisfied with blood, he neither blenched nor halted, but attended the courts, watched the progress of invisible agency in the prisons, and joined a multitude in witnessing the executions, end quote. When the Reverend Mr. Burroughs was executed, he, quote, rode around in the crowd on horseback, quote. It is said, quote, haranguing the people and saying that it was not to be wondered at that Mr. Burroughs appeared so well, for the devil often transformed himself into an angel of light, end quote. Charles Wentworth Upham, page 103. As to Cotton Mather's attending the courts when the witches were tried at Salem, himself and his accuser are directly at variance. The latter says he did attend. Mr. Mather affirms that he did not. Quote, I was not present, he says, at any of them, end quote. As to his frequenting the prisons where the witches were confined, he may have done this when any were confined in Boston. To do so, in the case of all prisoners, he believed to be a part of his ministerial duty. There is no evidence that he visited the prisoners in Salem, or that he was often there during the whole excitement. It was more of a journey from Boston to Salem in 1692 than it is at present. As to his joining the multitudes and witnessing the executions, I find no evidence that this is true except in a single instance. When Mr. Burroughs, with several others, was executed on the 5th of August, he was there. He was not, as has been represented, riding round in the crowd on horseback and ringing the people. Still, he was there and sitting on a horse. For certain reasons, Mr. Mather seems to have satisfied himself that Burroughs was, on many accounts, a bad man, a dangerous man, that he had been unkind in his family, was one who had intercourse with evil spirits, and who, of course, according to his understanding of the matter, deserved to die. And when he saw how worthily the old man appeared at the last, how submissive he was, and how fervently he prayed, it is very likely he may have said to the bystanders in the language of Paul, "No marvel, for Satan himself is transformed into an angel of light." This would be quite enough for such men as Caliph and others to make a story of, and is undoubtedly the substance out of which the several versions of the story have since been made. In order to understand the advices of the ministers above referred to, the history of the connected transactions must be kept in mind. As before related, the troubles in the family of Mr. Parris first made their appearance in February of 1692. During the next 3 months, cases of similar suffering were multiplied, and various persons were accused as being the cause of them. These accused persons were examined before Justice Corwin and Hathorne, and most of them were committed for trial. In May of the same year, Mr. Increase Master and Governor Phipps arrived from England with a new provincial charter of government. Almost immediately after the new government had been organized, a commission was issued to 7 of the principal citizens and jurists of the colony, constituting them a court to try the accused persons at Salem. The judges first assembled June 2nd and tried and condemned one, who was executed on the 10th. The court then adjourned to June 19th, in which interval the governor and council asked the advice of ministers in Boston and the vicinity as to the course to be pursued. After due deliberation, the ministers expressed their opinion and counsels under the 8 particulars 1. They expressed their sympathy with those who suffering by molestation from the invisible world and think that their condition calls for the utmost help of all persons in their several capacities. 2. They thankfully acknowledge the success which has followed the efforts of the magistrates to defeat the witchcraft and pray for a full and perfect discovery of all this mysterious wickedness. 3. They recommend a very critical and exquisite caution, lest by too much credulity for things received only upon the devil's authority, there be a door open for a long train of miserable consequences. 4. The rulers are exhorted not to proceed in any case on mere presumption, and to show an exceeding tenderness towards those that may be complained of, especially if they have been persons of an unblemished reputation. 5, the next advice is that the primary examination of suspected persons may be without noise, company, or excitement, and that there may be nothing used as a test for the trial of the suspected, the lawfulness whereof may be doubted by the people of God. 6, the ministers recommend to the magistrates not to convict or so much as commit persons on what was called the spectral evidence. Inasmuch as it is an undoubted thing that a demon may appear, even to ill purposes, in the shape of an innocent and virtuous man. They also pronounce any alteration made in the sufferers by a look or touch of the accused to be insufficient evidence of guilt. 7. The ministers further suggest whether an utter rejection of the testimonies commonly relied on, whose whole force and strength is from the devils alone, may not put a period to the progress of the terrible calamity begun upon us, and the accusation of so many persons, whereof some, we hope, are clear of the great transgression laid to their charge. 8. Having given the above directions, suggestions, and cautions, the ministers, quote, humbly recommend to the government the speedy and vigorous prosecution of such as have rendered themselves obnoxious, according to the directions given in the laws of God and the wholesome statutes of the English nation, end quote. By those who seem inclined to traduce the ministers of that day, and especially Cotton Mather, by whom these advices are said to have been drawn up, this last article is almost the only one quoted or referred to. It is quoted often as though it stood alone, without any restriction or qualification, as if Mather and his ministerial brethren were only anxious to have the judges make all due dispatch, and condemn and hang the suspected witches as fast as possible. But this, it will be seen, is altogether an unjust view of the case. These advices of the ministers are to be taken and judged as a whole, and as a whole they were manifestly framed and designed with a view to reprove much of the previous proceedings, particularly those of the Salem justices, and to prevent so far as possible the like proceedings in future. They do indeed recommend a speedy and vigorous prosecution of those who have justly rendered themselves obnoxious, but their recommendation is accompanied with such cautions, restrictions, and qualifications that had they been duly regarded, there probably had not been another individual convicted. If the trials had been conducted with that exceeding tenderness towards the accused which the ministers recommended, if the, quote, spectral evidence, together with all improper tests, had been set aside, if all testimony of every kind which rested only on the devil's authority had been rejected, the judges might have proceeded as vigorously as they pleased, the more vigorously the better, for by this means the jails had been the sooner emptied and the accused persons had been set at liberty. From persons who believed in the reality of witchcraft and that the proper witch is justly liable to death, as all these ministers most seriously did, I see not how better advices than those which they proffered to the magistrates on this occasion could reasonably have been expected, and happy had it been for all concerned if the magistrates had been content to follow them, but they would not. At least some of them would not, particularly Justice Stoughton. He seems to have been fully satisfied, at least for a time, as to the validity of the spectrum evidence and other branches of the devil's testimony, and consequently the work of hanging went on.
It's been further objected to Cotton Mather that after 200 persons have been accused, 150 imprisoned, 19 hanged, one pressed to death, and 28 condemned, one third of whom were members of the churches, and more than half of good general conversation. Then he wrote a formal treatise entitled Wonders of the Invisible World, approving the proceedings of the courts and exciting the multitude to a continuance in their belief and, of course, to a perseverance in their vindictiveness. Quincy, page 64, volume 1. With all due respect for the author of the foregoing sentence, I must say that the charge conveyed in the lateral part of it is no better than a libel. And a libel not on Cotton Mather alone, but on Stoughton, Winthrop, Sewall, and all the other members of the court. That these men were deluded and under the influence of strong delusion committed great injustice, I do not doubt. That they were vindictive in their feelings and judgments, I do not believe. There certainly is no evidence of their vindictiveness, but all the evidence that has come down to us goes to contradict directly such a supposition. Judge Sewall, in his humble confession several years after, makes no acknowledgement of vindictiveness. Chief Justice Stoughton affirmed that when he sat in judgment, he had the fear of God before his eyes and gave his opinion according to the best of his understanding. And although it might appear afterwards that he had been in error, yet he saw no necessity of a public acknowledgment. Cotton Mather, speaking of the judges, says, quote, "Although I was always afraid of proceeding to condemn any person upon so feeble evidence as a spectral representation, and ever protested against it, public and privately, and in my letters to the judges besought them that they would by no means admit it. Yet when I saw in most of the judges the most charming instance of prudence and patience, and knew the exemplary prayer and anguish of soul wherewith they had sought the direction of heaven above most other people, I could not but speak honorably of their persons on all occasions." In reference to these judges, the authors of the reply to Caleb say, quote, "What is done by them in the dark time of our troubles from the invisible world, all honest men believe they did in conscience of the oath of God upon them, and they followed, unto the best of their understanding, the precedents of England, Scotland, and other nations on such a dark and doleful occasion," end quote. Thus much in vindication of the judges from the charge of vindictiveness. The other part of the charge, namely that Cotton Mather and his wonders of the invisible world approved the proceedings of the courts and excited them to a perseverance in their vindictiveness, is equally without foundation. For in the first place, he did not altogether approve the proceedings of the courts. This is evident from what has been already said, particularly from the contrariety of their proceedings in the admission of testimony to his private letters to them, and to the advices of the ministers which he drew up. He further tells us expressly, quote, "I could not allow the principles that some of the judges had espoused," end quote. In his Magnalia, also, Mr. Mather expresses the opinion that the judges proceeded too far and were chargeable with mistakes, particularly in respect to the kind of evidence which they admitted and on which they, to some extent, relied. And if, as we have seen, the judges were not vindictive, it is impossible that Mr. Mather should have excited them to persevere in their vindictiveness. There is another fact in the life of Cotton Mather which is worthy to be mentioned here, and which shows that he did not altogether sympathize with the course pursued in reference to those who were thought to be bewitched. He offered at the beginning that if the possessed people might be scattered far asunder, he would singly provide for six of them, and he with some others would see whether prayer and fasting without resort to more bitter methods would not put an end unto these heavy trials, end quote. Had this method been taken in the case of the sufferers, it is probable that the country had not been disgraced, and that not one of the accused had lost his life under the charge of witchcraft. But it is further urged against Cotton Mather that, not satisfied with the tragedy of Salem, he tried all methods to prolong the excitement, and if possible to renew the same scenes in Boston. It is even said that he, quote, "got up a case of witchcraft in his own parish in 1693. He succeeded the next summer, says one, in getting up a wonderful case of witchcraft in the person of one Margaret Rule, a member of his congregation in Boston, from Bancroft's History, Volume 3, page 97, and Upham, page 289. In proof that Mr. Mather endeavored to prolong the excitement respecting witchcraft, and if possible to renew the Salem tragedy in Boston, a private letter has been produced addressed by him to Stephen Sewall of Salem, dated September 20, 1692, in which he requests his friend Sewall to send him, quote, "a narrative of the evidences given in at the trials of some of the principal witches which had there been recently condemned." His object in requesting such a narrative was that he might be the better able to meet objections against witchcraft and defend, so far as he should find them defensible, the proceedings of his friends at Salem. "I am willing," says he, writing in his usual familiar, playful style, "when you write, that you should imagine me as obstinate a Sadducee and witch advocate as any among us. Address me as one that believed not reasonable. And when you have knocked me down in a specter so unlike me, you will enable me to box it about among my neighbors till it come, I know not where, at last," end quote. The accusers of Mr. Mather seemed to understand from this letter that having collected all the witch stories he could find, he intended to color and magnify them and box them about among his neighbors till they came at last to something he could hardly tell what. But is this a correct interpretation of the letter? I am fully satisfied that it is not, and I am astonished that learned gentlemen should have so blundered upon it as they seem to have done. What was it, I asked, which Mr. Mather proposed to box about among his neighbors? Not the witch stories which his friend Sewall might send him, but the fallen specter of Sadduceeism which Sewall had knocked down. When you have knocked me down, and a specter so unlike me, you will enable me to box it, i.e. the fallen specter, about among my neighbors, till it, the specter, come, I know not where at last. Such is the strict proper grammatical meaning of the sentence, and it is very different, as everyone sees, from the forced perverted meaning which the accusers of Mr. Mather have put upon it. Mr. Mather was a firm believer in the reality of witchcraft, and like most men of that age, he regarded the disbelief of it as a sort of Sadduceeism which was little better than infidelity. This unbelieving spirit was working around him, and he sought the means of counteracting and overthrowing it. It was with this view, and not for the purpose of prolonging the excitement, that he wrote to his friend at Salem for a narrative of the evidence given in at the trials of some of the principal witches, which had just been condemned, end quote. That Mr. Mather had no agency in producing the strange appearances in Margaret Rule is very evident from several considerations. First, Caleb does not charge him with it or so much as intimate it. Secondly, he seems to have had no acquaintance with Margaret Rule or knowledge of her before her troubles commenced. But especially is it evident that Mr. Mather could have had no instrumentality in producing the troubles of Margaret from the very nature of her disease. Her case, though regarded by many at the time as one of witchcraft, was clearly of a very different character. It was no other than a protracted case of delirium tremens and other mental sufferings occasioned by the habitual use of rum. For 9 days together she swallowed little or nothing, quote, except an occasional spoonful of rum, end quote. When her attendants were asked, what does she eat and drink, they answered, she eats nothing at all but drinks rum. No wonder she saw specters around her and seemed to persons not acquainted with such appearances to have been bewitched. If this is the right explanation of her case, as I have no doubt it is, then Mr. Mather will stand clear of having produced it unless it can be shown that he persuaded her to drink rum and become a drunkard. In concluding the discussion concerning Cotton Mather's connection with the excitement respecting witchcraft, the following points seem to me to be well supported. Like most of the learned men of that age, Mr. Mather was a sincere believer in the reality of witchcraft, and that the witch, on due and proper conviction, was worthy of death. He had no concern in getting up cases of witchcraft in Boston or Salem or anywhere else, nor when they occurred did he rejoice in them. But they were to him, as they were to most others at that day, events of solemn and painful interest. In regard to the cases at Salem, he was not in favor at first of legal proceedings, but preferred that the bewitched persons should be separated and that religious means should be used for their recovery. And when judicial proceedings had been instituted, he was opposed to the admission of the spectral evidence or any other evidence which could be regarded as resting on the devil's authority. He privately wrote to the judges beseeching them not to proceed on such evidence, and drew up cautions and restrictions in the advices of the ministers, which, had they been duly regarded, would probably have saved the lives of all the accused. Nevertheless, believing the judges to be sincerely intent on doing right, he did not think it is his duty to oppose and vilify them, though he disapproved of some of their proceedings. After the executions were passed, at the command of Governor Phipps, he prepared and published a volume entitled Wonders of the Invisible World, containing, with other things, an attested history of the trials of some of the principal witches. Such are, in brief, the facts in relation to Mr. Mather's opinions and doings with reference to the subject of witchcraft. And for one, I find it little to censor, which may not be resolved into the peculiarity of his natural disposition and a solemn belief which, in common with most of that day, he cherished as to the reality of diabolical agency in the case. I would not, of course, undertake to defend every word he uttered and every action he performed during the whole of this perplexing business, but forgive him the wrong of his belief, if it be a wrong, and admit him to have been sincere and honest in his convictions, and I see little in what he did which does not at least appear consistent, and which, if it cannot be fully justified, may not readily be excused.